Dave Jensen.
Hey, still Wagstaff.
Man, Dave, you are looking alert, vigilant, eagle-eyed. What's your secret?
It's caffeinated beverages still. I have to drink a caffeinated beverage in order to stay awake these days.
A pity the weak, Dave. Me, it's just cold water. I'm running on cold water.
Splash it in your face every 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, in my ears, actually. I just syringe, shoot cold water in my ear. It's a jolt to the brain. They think I might develop meningitis, but it's worth it.
It's a sense that ear canal is sensitive, Steele. I have to look in ear canals all day. I upset people sometimes. I'm sorry, I just got to look in there.
It's like an ear dentist. That's like the worst possible job, Dave.
No, but it's very satisfying when you look in and you see that ear infection, because you're like, boom. Anybody could basically say, oh, yeah, that's an ear infection. But I get to pretend like I'm smart. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah, you got an ear infection.
Nice.
Like anybody that just looked in an ear and they see it, was like, oh.
Inflamed sack of pus. They're like, yeah, that's an infection. But you're like, well, science is telling me right now.
My doctorate in nursing leads me to believe that this is an ear infection.
Classic case of bursitis of the ear. Hey, well, speaking of infections, we've got an amazing guest tonight, Dave.
He keeps coming back. He's like a chronic infection.
He's like a rash you just can't treat. Spencer Gardner.
That's me. Putting the chronic in chronic infection.
Wow. Yeah, you know what time Dave got off work today, he was telling me?
4:20.
What?
Swung by the Little Caesars, picked up a pizza, boom.
Nice.
Hey, well, guys, big question, pressing question of the day. Off the chain, we recently celebrated our one-year anniversary, and Dave and I promised each other that if we made it to 2 years, we were going to get enormous tattoos. And so we're trying to decide what we want to get, what kind of body art we want to adorn ourselves with, and the listeners have been asking. So we thought we'd kind of run through some leading choices here tonight. Anybody have tattoo ideas?
I put a lot of thought to this recently, Steele, and I got a great answer. Large letters across my back, and of course I'll have to start doing steroids to really make it show up.
So you have room for all the letters you need? Right now you can only do like a three-letter word?
Yeah, I'm only going to be able to do four of the 10 letters I'm planning. But it's going to be me, Familia, just in that kind of gothic
lettering. Black letter script.
Yes, and then beneath it on the rest of my back is going to be poorly done photorealistic pictures of each one of my 5 children.
Oh, nice. Are you going to have them arranged in any order, like Olympic rings, or are you going to have it like just in a line, or is it going to be like a cross? You could do a cross.
I was thinking more of like, the dice pattern of 5. There's 2 there, 1 there, 2 there.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So which 2 are on top?
I'll just go into the tattoo not knowing for sure it'll be whoever pleased me the most that day.
I don't know why you haven't screaming. You got to stage an arm wrestling contest and have him like wrestle for the top spots.
Who wants the top? Let's do this.
Lords. 1, 2, 3, go.
What about you, Spence? I know you've put some thought to this too. You've been on enough to where you're thinking about getting the tat as well.
Yeah. So I was just talking about this on Sunday with Emmeline. It would definitely be justice on one bicep and mercy on the other.
I was thinking you were going to do the sunburst around the navel, Spence. That's totally you.
I don't know.
But to pull that off, Spence, you got to hit the gym. You can't just walk around like, I like to bike to work. You got to hit the gym if you're going to do that.
Spence.
I have strength that you wouldn't even understand.
You should get it, Spence, so that when your arms are just flaccid and not flexed, it's lowercase justice, but when you flex, it becomes uppercase. All caps.
And I could hide a line somewhere in like a crease so that when I flex, it's underlined.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. You do have a lot of creases in your upper arms, Spence. You might want to get that looked into.
There's a lot of excess skin on me.
Yeah.
All right, guys. So this was a question that's close to my own heart as well, because, as you'll see, that's a literal statement. But when I, for years and years, for the last 20 years maybe, until my life changed recently, there was no real question. I knew there was only one tattoo I was going to get. Do you guys remember the animated version of Peter Pan, right?
Yes.
Like the Disney version?
What's that?
The Disney version?
Yeah, with Hook and Tinkerbell, and I think there's a guy named Smee in it, right?
Yeah.
Well, Smee has a tattoo, and it's like an anchor and a heart, and it just says Mom. And I've always, I was like, the classic, I want that tattoo. I just need it. And for years, I was like, that's my go-to tattoo. When I get a tattoo, it's just going to be like a heart with Mom in it, you know? And it's tough to top that. But
wait, so has something changed? What's going on? How can you top it?
Well, see, the thing is, I had a son, Dave, and I was thinking about this, and I've been thinking actually semi-seriously about this, designing a tattoo and actually getting one. It'd be a big stretch for me, but what I would want to do would be a cedar tree with a laurel entwined around it, and I would tattoo it like over my left chest, like left breast over my heart. It's my family, my great loves, Laurel and Cedar, the two trees.
Beautiful.
I can't criticize it. I'm dedicating my whole back to my family. So, of course, dedicate your heart, your breast.
And Spence is dedicating his biceps to the two principles which rule his life.
That's and right. Rule his family, from what I understand.
Yes.
Listen, kids, you want justice or do you want mercy tonight? Which one do you want giving you a black eye?
So you might consider also taking the elements, the periodic table of the elements, take the symbols that represent the different alloys in steel.
Oh, nice.
And putting them somewhere on there too.
I was thinking that, I won't tell you where I was thinking to tattoo that.
I'm sure Dan Dienajon can tell you where to tattoo it.
Oh, jeez. So just check the website in the upcoming months. We'll be posting pictures of our tattoos when they're done. Mine's going to be pretty detailed, so it's going to take some time, I think.
And if you want to win the chance to actually perform the tattoo on Spencer, he's open to anybody. I mean, submissions from prison, highly welcome. Write in with your a couple of homemade photos of your recent work, and Spence will consider letting you ink them.
You just have to be willing to work with skin folds. That's all you got to be able to do, so...
And unsterilized needles.
Yeah. Spence only likes unsterilized. He doesn't believe in sterilized needles.
No.
Well, we covered the tattoos. And speaking of tattoos, some tremendous body art has been on display. One of the great, I guess, modern art museums, really, is the NBA playoffs. If you look in the NBA playoffs, you see some of the world's great body art. Because the NBA jersey is just a tank top. It exposes these long-limbed, often gorgeously adorned men. All of us on this podcast today are big sports ball fans. Some of us have been following the NBA playoffs some religiously. And one of the things that's really characterized this year, this last postseason, has been abysmal, atrocious officiating, particularly officiating that benefits the Oklahoma City Thunder. We've all suspected the league has a very strong Oklahoma City bias. It's the big city, I guess. The big city gets what it wants. It's that OKC bias that the media is famous for.
The officials are just, they're intimidated by the Oklahoma City Thunder crowds. They're intimidated by just the power that Oklahoma City holds. I mean, you look at it against the Spurs, we got waiters elbowing Ginobili in the face. We got Adams
uncalled.
Setting an illegal screen.
Oh, that was dirty, dirty.
That just makes me love him more. And then did you see just the other night, Westbrook clearly traveled with the ball at the end of the Warriors game. And no one called it.
Spencer sent me an outraged email the next morning about this.
It was right in front of the referee.
You know,
were you watching this, Spence?
I was watching it, yeah.
Wow.
He was live streaming it on his Ubuntu computer.
That's right. No, Emeline and I watched.
That pleases me so much. Who were you rooting for during this game?
I root for good basketball, but I was pulling for Golden State, I think. I like them. I think they're entertaining to watch, although they were not as entertaining last night.
No, they had a tough game.
They did.
I was just trying to enjoy the game, but every once in a while, I just go with the darkness. Like Westbrook seems like a villain to me, kind of.
Oh, man.
I'm a huge fan. I love it. And Adams, Like, he's clearly, like, trying to hurt people and make everyone angry. I love it.
Yeah, Emmeline was watching, too, and at first she wasn't sure what to make of Adams, and then she decided she really liked him.
Yes.
Mostly because of the mustache.
Oh, yeah.
But yes. When she saw Cantor, she just laughed and couldn't get over the laughing stage. Oh, that's right. It was the nose plug. She's reminding me. When she saw the nose, because he got a bloody nose at some point. When she saw the nose plug, she was like, all right, I like that guy.
Oh, if someone made a poster with those guys saying Twin Towers, Cantor, and Adams, it would be in my living room, no doubt.
Yeah, the world's two best-looking men, that's for sure.
But still, this has not just been an issue in this playoffs. Officiating is kind of always an issue in the NBA and, well, throughout pro sports. There's always going to be times when the referee or the official is just gonna blow it.
I feel like the NBA is particularly egregious, though, Dave, because I don't know. I'm coming to think more and more that these games and series are a little bit rigged and fixed. Like, the league has an interest in certain series going seven games, and like, because games can be close and officials can make kind of borderline calls or non-calls, and it really can swing the game. I've just been feeling that more and more. Like, officials are determining or fixing the probabilities a little bit in these NBA games, and it makes me feel really gross.
Yeah, I was talking to my brother-in-law about it, and he said he doesn't watch the games anymore because of that. He feels like the officials have too much of a hand in what's going on. Like, the classic example for this, if you go to any NBA conspiracy theorist blog, it's the 2002 Western Conference finals. Kings versus the Lakers.
This is like a black hole for me, Dave, because I was on my mission. And I think all of it. Were you on your mission at that time or no?
If I wasn't, I wasn't involved in watching sports at that time.
I've only read about this. This is like the JFK assassination for me, basically. I've only read about it and seen it on YouTube. But yeah, I don't know how this could be considered a legitimate basketball series. Like, it was clear, blatant, official fixing. Is it not?
Yeah, just a couple stats for you. In game six, the Lakers shot 40 free throws compared to the Kings 25. But the real disparity was in the fourth quarter. They shot 27 free throws compared to the Kings 9.
27 free throws in 12 minutes.
They just ignored Mike Bibby getting elbowed in the face. Shaq just violated Vlade Divac, I think he needs to be in the OTC Hall of Fame, but because we love Vlade. But it's just amazing.
Mostly for his work as Sacramento's GM, though, I will say. Not had nothing to do with his work as a player.
Well, his chain smoking at halftime. That's okay. Got to get him in.
Yeah, he's first ballot for sure. Yeah, so I don't know, Spence. You were talking with me a little bit about this distaste for officiating here. You got a theory?
Yeah. Well, coming back to last night, the game last night, there was the travel call. But I also felt like they were really babying Westbrook during the game, especially in the third quarter. He had a great third quarter. But they called like several fouls on the guy that was defending him. And I don't know, they seemed really questionable to me. The hard part of it is, especially in basketball, I feel like a lot of the calls are arbitrary.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of contact that's happening at any given moment. And, it, you know, if you read the rules literally, any contact should not be allowed. Or I guess there is some contact allowed. But, you know, if a defender is not allowing the player with the ball to get past him, somebody is at fault there. And they often don't call those fouls. So then when the referee decides to call it, it looks unfair. I don't know. It seems arbitrary.
I remember this being an issue even in the Michael Jordan days. Like, as a kid, I was like a Utah Jazz fan, and so we had to hate Jordan. And everybody would just gripe because Jordan seemed to get the star treatment, all the calls, every time. There's that classic moment of him, like, basically pushing Brian Russell to the ground right before hitting that game-winning, like, season-ending, series-ending jumper. And you're like, yeah, that's clearly not allowed by the rules of the game, but is anyone ever going to call an offensive foul on Michael Jordan in the last seconds of a basketball game?
Yeah.
What's funny about that moment is it's been replayed so many times. Just anybody that's just a casual NBA fan has seen it hundreds of times. And it's clearly like he fouled him. He pushed him out of the way and hit it. And this is like one of these classic clutch plays. Like, I think a lot of guys can make clutch plays if you're allowed to push the defender out of your way.
Great moments of basketball greatness.
I remember seeing that when I was in real time and being really angry because I was also a Jazz fan. But I remember even like in the moment feeling like, wow, this is kind of historic because everybody thought this was Jordan's last season and it probably should have been. Anyway, that was definitely a no call that sticks out in my mind. But you're right that like how could you call that?
I have to say also, Spencer, I love that your ideal of basketball is a sport in which no physical contact occurs. Because, Dave, Spencer and I play basketball together on Thursday nights, and that is literally how Spencer plays basketball. He's awesome. He's like a really great defender, but he'll go to great lengths, and he's at great pains to make sure that he never once even accidentally touches you. Not while defending you, not while driving the ball, not while rebounding, like... Sometimes Spencer and I will go like four games guarding each other without making any physical contact. It's amazing.
I have a fear of physical contact.
It's amazing you got two kids. It's impressive. Yeah.
It was all
turkey baster.
It was not real. Artificial means, Dave.
Oh, I know a thing or two about that. So yeah, I think I agree with you guys that the NBA of the four professional sports, it's probably the one that's most shaped by the officials. They can really make a difference. I mean, we're going to talk in a couple minutes about one of the greatest officials in NBA history, Tim Donaghy, that shaped a lot of games with how he officiated. But it also happens in other sports, certainly like baseball. The umpire can just call whatever strike zone he feels like at that time.
And I feel like baseball, I was going to say that my feeling was baseball is probably the one where the officials have the least amount of discretion. But I think you're right. Like strike zone framing is something that's pretty subtle. Football feels like it's just as manipulable since like technically probably some kind of violation occurs on every play. And it's just selective when the flag is thrown. I think that's the criticism of the Seahawks defense, I guess, the last couple of years. They're like, well, when you commit pass interference on every play, they are only going to call a small percentage of them. And that's a great effective defense.
The thing about baseball, though, is, assuming that they're calling it equally both ways, I think pitchers learn to adjust to the strike zone that's being called. So it almost becomes like an element of the game that's just part of the strategy.
It's a nightly calibration.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dave, you had an instance or somebody named an instance of a pretty egregious instance of where a baseball game was pretty clearly influenced by an officiating, I don't know what the word for it is.
Yeah, and it was in favor of the most villainous team.
I know, but Dave probably loved it.
So, I remember this. I was 16. I lived in New Jersey. My favorite sport at the time, my favorite team by far. I've been to a lot of these games, the Yankees. I love the New York Yankees. Game one, ALCS, Yankees versus Orioles, 1996. Derek Jeter hits a fly ball, clearly a home run. Except for the fact that clearly a 12-year-old kid, like this kid became famous in the New York metro area, Jeffrey Meyer, he just reached out, took it away from the outfielder. He reached onto the playing field and caught it. Like clearly he was out there. And this kid became like a folk hero. And the umpires just missed it. They just like, home run, Jeter. Orioles were like, really good that year too.
He's like the reverse Steve Bartman.
Yeah, he really is.
I bet people still like shake his hand and love that kid.
Yeah, we need to do a where is Jeffrey Meyer now? I wonder whether he's just like been coasting in his life, like he's got like some cushy job in the New York's like stock exchange where he doesn't do anything just because he's like, oh, you're that guy. Thanks.
he carries the ball around with him. Yeah, this is it, guys. This is the one.
So he just wears a baseball glove everywhere he goes.
I don't remember this game. I didn't watch the American League because I was a National League guy. But I was hating the Yankees.
Of course you were, Spencer.
I have to say, Dave, I didn't actually realize that you cared about the Yankees or baseball until the time that you were trying to watch, I think it was the division series against the Red Sox.
Oh, yeah.
And Howard.
What year that was, right? You know what series that was.
It was the 3-0 series lead.
Yeah.
2004, it was game 4. The Yankees were winning. 3-0 series lead. And Howard just starts, I don't know even what he did, but he started harassing me to the point where I couldn't watch the game. And the Yankees never won another game in the series. The worst collapse ever, and it was Howard's fault.
Snowy reception on that TV. I don't think you were getting a clear signal anyway.
I could see it.
Howard wanted you to come down for family home evening, Dave.
Yeah, Dave, priorities, man. Something was not right in your life. You can't expect blessings. Come down, you can't expect the Lord to bless you, Dave, if you're not putting family first.
That's right. Yeah, random college kids. Yeah, dang it. And honestly, since that day, I don't think I've watched baseball. I haven't liked baseball nearly as much. Howard cursed me.
Now, that's the mark of a true friend. So the last one that I want to talk about, though, is I want to switch sports as well, because I was thinking about major sports where officials don't influence it as much, and I was going to say soccer, but I think that's kind of true and untrue in that soccer games usually are such low-scoring affairs that if a penalty is given, that's the easiest sport for an official to, like, fix a game. Although penalties aren't given that often, like, that makes all the difference in the world. But the most famous instance, I think, of the officials kind of swinging a World Cup game is not a penalty at all. It's them wrongly allowing a clearly illegal goal. And this is prior to any of our television watching lifetimes, unless you were watching the World Cup at like 4 or 5 years old. But Diego Maradona, 1986, Argentina versus England, World Cup. Who wants to take it from here? I mean, tell the story.
Just a classic. I wish that I could talk to an English guy about this right now.
Oh, man.
Because I feel like it would still be like a deep anger in them. So he clearly uses a handball to control the ball and then score a goal. Just an egregious handball.
He punches the ball, jumps up and punches it with his hand next to his head.
He said it was partly his head and partly the hand of God.
He has a pretty high opinion of himself, it sounds like.
The thing is, this whole instance, soccer to me is a study in manipulating the rules in your favor. So, like, I mean, soccer players are famous for flopping, right?
Sounds like someone who lived in Italy talking right now.
Yeah, they're famous for it. And in this case, if you watch the video, he does a really good job of selling it with his head, even though his head basically doesn't even make contact with the ball. I actually wonder, and there's probably history that I'm not aware of, whether the officials actually thought it was a goal or whether there was something else going on.
Oh.
But he certainly sold it.
Yeah, I think the referee who was on the sideline, or the side judge or whatever, was at an angle where his hand was on the other side, so he couldn't see it. And in the cases like that, like Maradona's the greatest player in the world, you're like, this tiny guy, of course he could do it. This guy's amazing. He could do anything. The thing that's kind of overlooked from that game is Argentina won that game 2-1, and Maradona scored the other goal in that game. And it was a goal in which he dribbled past like 8 or 9 English players. He scored it from – he like made this mazy run from midfield. It's one of the great goals in World Cup history. So he scored one like world-class, perfect, legitimate goal and one sneaky-as-hell cheat goal. And that's what beat England, and that's perfect. That's just beautiful.
I couldn't want more for England than that. That is great. Every time the World Cup comes around, there's so many hopes there. And like, there's always some awesome way that they're going to falter, and it's great.
Surprising faltering. We're going to talk for a second about important moments. We had a little prelude here, but talking about Tim Donaghy. But important moments in sports gambling history. I know that you're both degenerate gamblers. Spencer, I think, isn't currently not even wearing a shirt. He lost it at his bookies last month.
Yeah, and I don't normally wear pants either, so I'm pretty much naked these days.
Full Monty. All right, so what do we got? Sports gambling history. What's an important moment in your heart?
I got some quick hitters here.
Okay.
1919 Chicago Black Sox.
Ooh.
They took money to throw the World Series. Have you guys ever seen the movie 8 Men Out?
Yes, so good.
Classic, and it's all the fault of, what is the guy's name, Michael Rooker.
Yeah.
He took the whole team down, and this is the same guy that in Cliffhanger blames Stallone for the death of his girlfriend that was clearly his fault. This guy's always causing problems, and he is the reason why the 1919 White Sox threw the series, and Shoeless Joe banned from baseball for life.
You know, a lot of people don't know this, but this guy was also Yondu Udonta a blue-skinned interstellar bandit with a less-than-perfect paternal relationship from the movie Guardians of the Galaxy. Haven't seen it, but I just read that off the internet.
Yeah, he was not a nice guy in that film either.
He led the Ravagers. I mean, talk about bad dudes.
A huge fan, Pete Rose, should still be in the game. He was betting on his own team still. That's one thing we got to remember.
Betting for on his own team to win, we should clarify.
To win. Yeah.
And when you say still be in the game, I hope you mean he should still be playing. That would be awesome. He should be first baseman for life for the Cincinnati
he
Reds.
He would still be good.
Yeah.
Charlie Hustle.
Yeah. Talk about a handsome man. That guy has aged well. Another classic moment of sports gambling. This one influenced my childhood. The movie with Robert Redford and Kim Basinger, The Natural. This is probably the film I've seen more than any other film ever made. Did you know that, Dave?
That's sad, because it's not very good until the final scene is maybe the greatest final scene of all time.
Dave, okay.
Don't you remember when he knocked the cover off the ball? That's not in the final scene, and that's hella awesome.
Yeah.
It doesn't even look like he knows how to play baseball throughout the film.
That's what makes the final scene so impressive.
So wait a second, Dave. You will believe that Vin Diesel can jump off a car falling off of a bridge.
Hey, watch yourself, Spence.
But Robert Redford isn't able to hit a baseball?
Hey, what's more believable, Spence? Think about it for half a second. Like, Diesel does that. That's routine. Robert Redford, that guy could barely run around the bases at the time. It was awesome.
But Wilford Brimley was really good in that movie.
That's true. Oscar worthy.
Yeah.
Wait, what's the gambling connection? I forget.
Honestly. I don't even know,
so
but...
The owner, I don't remember the exact arrangement, but basically the owner of the team has an agreement with the general manager that involves, like, who...
Oh, they're going to lose or something.
...some shares from the team at the end of the season or something. So the owner's basically trying to throw the season by putting all these, like, nobodies on the team, which is why Roy Hobbs, the main character, gets put on, because he's this kind of old guy that they don't think is any good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when they find out that he's really good, they try to bribe him. And then before the last game, he returns the bribe to the owner and is like, I'm not going to do it.
Oh, Redford. He's got integrity. I'll give him that.
Hey, Spence, spoiler alert. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
All right. Other
the game-winning home run or not.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you're all in suspense. Yeah. Dave, you've got a lot of stuff in this list about refusing to go down. I hope this doesn't mean what I think it means.
Yes, it's a boxing reference.
Oh, okay.
Two huge boxing ones. Daredevil's dad in the comics, in the show, whatever. He takes money from the mob to go down in a certain round in the boxing match. And he takes that money and he bets it on himself. And he knocks the guy out instead because he's trying to save money for his son's future so he can go to law school when he's blind. But he ends up getting killed by the mob. Bruce Willis.
Yeah, surprising twist of events there.
Bruce Willis, Pulp Fiction, refuses to go down. He tries to escape, forgets his dad's watch. It's a huge issue.
A couple other famous movie gambling, sports gambling scenes. Basically the whole movie, White Man Can't Jump. You guys ever seen that? Woody Harrelson, Wesley Snipes, Rosie Perez. It's about hustling. You know, you got this white guy, he's like, oh, he's just hanging around in the playground bag. Any two of us take you 2-on-2, and it's Woody Harrelson, and he'll get in, and they'll beat you, take your money. But he bets it all and loses at the end because he wants to prove that white men can jump and can dunk. But the moral of the story, the lesson is they cannot. They yeah. cannot.
It's in the title of the movie, Woody. You got to think about that.
Yeah, it was subtitled The Larry Bird Story.
But still, the hugest movie gambling that I think every person that's ever watched movies and watched sports has put a lot of thought into is Back to the Future 2, Biff Tannen.
Yeah. I have never seen this movie, Dave.
What?
It's true. I've seen one, and I've seen three a bunch, but I never saw two. It was too dark for me, too dystopian.
So Spence, explain it to him so he can join the rest of the human race.
So at the end of one, Doc comes back to Marty and says, "Hey, we got to go." And comes in the flying DeLorean. Mm. So then in part two, Marty McFly goes to the future gets his hands on a sports almanac, comes back to the present day, and Biff Tannen is able to get his hands on the almanac. Mm. So he now has sports scores and outcomes for I don't know how many years into the future, but he can make a lot of money betting on it. So Marty goes back to the future, and it's now an alternate future where Biff Tannen has tons of money and power because he's been able to bet on all these games. So then Marty has to restore justice to the world.
What's awesome about this premise is that it imagines a future in which someone is powerful and derive their power from sports gambling. That's like the least plausible route to power, like ever imaginable, I think.
Unless you have the sports almanac.
Even so, you're just rich.
I want the sports almanac.
I do too, but that doesn't give you any like of all the sources of money that might translate to power in the world, you're like, how'd you make your millions? Sports betting. You're like, oh yeah, instant respect. This guy did it.
Think about it though. If you bet on stocks, eventually you're going to get found out because the SEC is going to come after you. Mm. They'll figure you've got some insider info or something. Nobody's going to look at a sports gambler and really bother them for being successful.
It's the perfect crime.
Exactly.
It's exactly how Mitt Romney made all his money.
He's the real Biff Tannen. All right. Scott Ferris, you want to tell us that story, Dave?
Oh, yeah. I used to go to the horse track when I was like 18. It was Jersey. The coolest thing in the world in Jersey. And because you could gamble at the horse track when you're 18. And I would never win. But one night, Scott Ferris took us. I might have been pre-gambling age. I might have been like 16. So right at the last end of the night, he bet an exacta. Do you know what an exacta is?
Yeah.
You pick the first two horses to finish 1-2. And he picked it, and he nailed it. So Scott Ferris won like $150, so we got to go to dinner after the horse race that night. It was awesome.
This was like a Charles Dickens novel. If Scott Ferris hadn't won, Dave would go to bed hungry for like the 14th night in a row. But Dave finally got to eat. Tiny Tim has dinner because of Scott Ferris wins.
That brought me over 100 pounds. That dinner is what did it.
Otherwise, I'd be sweeping up peanut shells. Amazing.
Thank you, Scott Ferris.
Thank you, Scott Ferris. You're the reason Dave does not have sickle cell anemia today. I don't know if that's even diet related. Probably not. I need to ask a nurse.
That's genetic, but that's all right. Any other big ones here that you guys want to cover?
I just want to say the name Paul Foy. Have you guys heard of this guy?
Uh-uh.
Yeah. You need to read this story. I'll put up a link on the website. This is like the world's biggest bookie. He's been running an illegal sports book for years and years. The FBI arrested him and then had to let him go on this weird technicality. It's this crazy, crazy global poker illegal betting story. It's just nuts. So
yeah, and then let's hear it for Lester.
Oi.
Yeah, you talked about it on one of the last episodes.
Yeah.
5,000 to 1 odds.
A couple people placed those bets. Like there's a couple firemen that put up £5 each and they just made off with like £25,000. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Pretty good bets.
Just imagine what you could do if you had the sports almanac still. Biff Tannen would have cleaned up on that.
You're right. I got to rethink everything. I love sports almanacs, by the way. I didn't have them from the future, but I definitely have a bunch from the past. And I used to just read them cover to cover. That explains a lot about me. Yeah.
So all you need to do is invent a time machine and get them back to your former self.
It's great. That'd been awesome. All right. So Unchained Melodies this week. And Dave, you struck on a brilliant idea for our theme. Could you tell us a bit about how lightning hit you?
So lately there's been a lot of kind of surprise albums that have just been dropping on us. That's like the thing to do. Radiohead, Beyonce.
We just bought Lemonade, Dave.
That's terrific. I'm excited. I haven't listened to it, but I'm sure it's great. But the thing to do in the 90s still, what did bands do in the 90s?
The thing
they
that you
did.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I thought you were asking me.
No.
Shut up. Shut up still.
It's a rhetorical question still. Come on. They hid tracks at the end of their CDs.
Yeah.
And it's super exciting. After a while, you'd always let the CD play at the end just in case. Mm. You always kept your fingers crossed, like, is there a hidden track?
Dave, I had forgotten about this phenomenon, but when I thought of it today, my mind just went back to some happy times. And to prove how awesome this was, I was at the sandbox today. All the kids are playing at the sandbox. Everybody there is like 30-something. And I said, hey, you guys remember CDs? And everybody's like, yeah, what are you talking about? And I was like, think about this. Hidden tracks, CDs you owned in the 90s, what were the best ones? And everybody like instantly started smiling and was like, oh, yeah. And like, I just became a popular guy in my neighborhood because of I said this at the sandbox today.
Oh man, that's a small talk topic.
It's pretty. It's like the best small talk I could have imagined. Did you know, for example, your favorite band, Dave Hansen, Mbop?
Yeah.
They released a Christmas album, and that Christmas album has a secret track. I'm not going to spoil it for our listeners, but you guys need to go look it up. It sounds really off the chain.
That sounds like an entire episode of its own. Just
really
exploring
should
exploring Hansen's Christmas hidden track.
Yeah. All right. So Dave,
did they throw out? Did your neighbors throw out any like excellent hidden tracks? Or
yes, the second one my neighbors mentioned is one that Spencer's going to play for us tonight, and I was like, oh my goodness, you need to meet my friend Spencer. He's gonna. It's Spencer's favorite band, and they're like, oh yeah, this song's great, and I was like, what? What? You reading my mind, Spencer? Man. That's probably where we need to lead off, Spencer. What do you got for us?
Yeah, this is Travis. I have long had a thing for Travis. So Blue Flashing Light, the name of the hidden track, this was on their album The Man Who, which I consider to be one of the greatest albums of the 90s. Yeah, it's pretty hard-hitting.
And I'm going to jump kind of in the middle of it because it's on the Spotify. It's not separated as its own track. That song encapsulates everything I believe about parenting, Spence.
Justice and mercy, I'm telling you.
But honestly, it sounds exactly like a hidden track. Uh-huh. It has a very heavy 90s feel. There's kind of a grit and edge to it that Travis wouldn't necessarily have put on one of the listed album tracks. It's like just a perfect example.
It's a little treat, a reward for their super fans. I think that's beautiful. Encapsulates it well.
A little upper at the end of the album about domestic abuse.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Here's the one I want to play for you. There's a singer-songwriter named Todd Snyder. I ordered his record from the BMG Music Club, Songs for the Daily Planet. And this was the secret last song. It was called Talkin' Seattle Blues. And it basically made fun of the Seattle alternative scene, and I loved this song for years and years.
Hey, hey, my, my, rock and roll will never die. Just hang your hair down in your eyes, you'll make $1 million. I was in this band going nowhere fast. We sent out demos, but everybody passed. So one day we finally took the plunge, moved out to Seattle to play some grunge. Washington State, that is. Space Needle. Eddie Vedder. Mutton, honey. Fast, we wear flannel shirts. We turn our amps up until it hurts. We got bad attitudes, and what's more, when we play, we stare straight down at the floor while we. Pretty scary. How pensive. How totally alternative. Now, to fit in on the Seattle scene, you gotta do something they ain't never seen. So, thinking up a gimmick one day, we decided to be the only band that wouldn't play a note. Under any circumstances. silence. Music's original alternative. Roots grunge.
It just goes on to higher and higher heights from there, but that was epic.
Steel, I got to be honest, as you were describing it, I was sure that it was going to suck really bad. And then when it didn't, I was really surprised. Like, I genuinely thought it was humorous.
Great
job.
Thanks, Dave. 13-year-old Steel had great taste in novelty hidden tracks.
Guys, if you want the greatest novelty hidden track of all time, you have to look at the band Cracker. This is probably their best song.
I don't know why
they hid it, but it was well hidden. And when you found it, you were super stoked. Euro Trash Girl.
Dave, can I tell you one of my great disappointments in life?
Yeah.
I bought the Kerosene Hat cassette tape to play in my car, and the hidden track is not on the cassette tape.
Oh, jeez. That is the worst. You should write a poem about that.
I really should. How did they get to the chorus? I kept not fading it because I thought the chorus was coming next. I forgot how long that song is.
I did not realize that was a hidden track.
Oh, gosh. So well hidden. When it's that well hidden, you don't have to hurry to the chorus. It's a slow builder.
It's like their biggest hit, too.
Same guy that wrote Take the Skinheads Bowling. He's great at that sort of thing.
James Lowry, is that his name? What's his name?
He's a big advocate for copyrighted music rights.
Oh, really?
David Lowry, yeah.
David Lowry.
He doesn't like these lyric sites on the internet. He's very much against them.
I'm glad we could plug his stance on copyright tonight.
So this is the Beatles. Some people think this is the original hidden song. Her Majesty, apparently it was recorded by Paul McCartney before the rest of the Beatles came to record Abbey Road. He didn't want it included on the album, but the engineers had been instructed not to throw anything away. So it ended up getting tacked on to the end of the album. And then the Beatles liked it once it was there and kind of hidden. So there it is, Her Majesty.
Pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, someday I'm gonna make 'em mine. Oh, yeah.
They didn't want to make a mind.
Great. Lovely little ditty, Spence. I didn't know any of the backstory there, but makes me appreciate it all the more.
Spence, I love that song. If the girls demand I sing them an extra song and I just don't want to, I'll sing them that one because it only takes like 10 seconds. And it usually satisfies them. It's good enough. But guys, you may not know this, but my favorite band of all time is probably Wilco. You guys, I don't know if you've ever been aware of that, but they have a hidden track that I still... Yeah, Wilco, Jeff Tweedy. But they have a hidden track that I love, and I still actually, I sing this one to my girls quite a bit too. It's one of my favorite songs by them. It's called Candy Floss.
Kind of Calliope sound there, Dave.
Yeah, it has a real poppy 60s feel to it. Just a fun song.
Mm-hmm. It's a great opening. And that's one of my favorite, that is my favorite Wilco album.
Yeah, it's funnest. I think it's the easiest to approach. Summer Teeth is great.
All right, guys. I got a lot of pressure on me picking the last hidden track here. First thought I thought of. First one I thought of was definitely that. It was from the Green Day Dookie record. You guys remember All By Myself?
Yes.
Classic.
I remember riding the bus to junior high, and some kid was in the back playing that song, thinking he was so cool.
He probably was. He must have been cool.
And then I thought of the Nirvana Endless Nameless at the end of Nevermind. That's like an epic track and so Nirvana-y, and that was pretty iconic. But I'm going to go with Beck. You guys know he's my original heartthrob. And the first one I thought of was actually the hidden track at the end of Odelay, that computer noise. I think it's called Computer Rock. But Spencer convinced me. Spencer's into the deep cuts. Spencer's into the acoustic Beck. At the end of the Mutations, there's a song that's beautifully titled Diamond Bollocks.
Some dead world that looks so new. Offices and mountains that they mean for you. Dazzlements of accidents rejoice their doom. Every carriage spinning round the golden moon.
Eight genres, 30 seconds. Who else does it like Beck?
Oh, man. I could do like another dozen of these things. Hidden tracks are just so exciting.
They really are. That's one of the things you lose. I mean, like, the thing that was sad about this, Dave, I was putting this playlist together. Spotify just includes them as if they were normal tracks at the end of each of these records. except for the Travis one, they're just like, someone goes on Spotify and listens to the album. They never knew that you had to wait 3 minutes and 70 seconds or whatever for the song to end and then like press the rewind, fast forward button and find a hidden track. Like kids these days, you know?
They probably wouldn't have known to wait 3 minutes and 70 seconds because that's kind of a weird time.
Yeah, some people count minutes and 60 seconds, but not if you want to find that hidden track. You got to count in base 100, Spence.
You got to be serious about this.
All right, Dave, you got book wisdom for us to take us home? Sports ball?
I do. So, guys, one of my favorite authors is Don DeLillo, and his magnum opus is Underworld, this 700-page just sprawling novel. It starts off with essentially a novella about the shot heard around the world, a famous home run from the 1950s by the New York Giants to get into the World Series. And I'm just going to read part of when Bobby Thompson hits the home run. Not a good pitch to hit, up and in, but Thompson swings and tomahawks the ball, and everybody watches. Except for Gleason, who has been over in his seat, hands locked behind his neck, a creamy strand of slime swinging from his lips. Russ says, "There's a long drive." His voice has a burst in it, a charge of expectation. He says, "It's gonna be." There's a pause all around him. Patco racing towards the left field corner. He says, "I believe." Pafco at the wall. Then he's looking up. People thinking, where's the ball? The scant delay, the stay in time that lasts a hair's breadth, and Cotter standing in section 35, watching the ball come in his direction. He feels his body tumble to smoke. He loses sight of the ball when it climbs above the overhang, and he thinks it will land in the upper deck. But before he can smile or shout or bash his neighbor on the arm, before the moment can overwhelm him, the ball appears again, stitches visibly spinning. That's how near it hits, banging at an angle off a pillar, hands flashing everywhere. Russ feels the crowd around him, a shudder passing through the stands, and then he is shouting into the mic, and there is a surge of color and emotion, a crash that occurs upward, stadium-wide, hands and faces and shirts, bands of rippling men, and he is outright shouting. His voice has a power he thought long gone. It may lift the top of his head like a cartoon rocket. He says, "The Giants win the pennant." A top spin line drive. He tomahawked the pitch, and the ball had top spin and dipped into the lower deck. And there's Pafco at the 315 sign looking straight up with his right arm braced at the wall and a spade of paper coming down. He says, "The Giants win the pennant." Yes, the voice is excessive with a tickle of hysteria in the upper register, but it is mainly wham and womp. He sees Thompson capering around first. The hat of the first base coach has flung his hat straight up. He went for a chin-high pitch and cold-cocked it good. The ball started up high and then sank, missing the facade of the upper deck and dipping into the seats below. Pulled in, swallowed up, and the Dodger players stood looking, already separated from the event, staring flat into the shadows between the decks. He says, "The Giants win the pennant."
Wait, he both freezes that moment and speeds it up, and you feel it all, Dave, the depths of the joy of a 60-something-year-old baseball moment.
It's beautifully described. It's just this moment, this game, takes about 30 pages for DeLillo to go through, and interesting and gripping.
Well, gentlemen, it has been a pleasure. Spencer, thanks for coming on. It's been a joy.
Thank you.
Good night, gentlemen.
Off the chain. It's off the chain. Welcome to this world. It's off the chain.
I just got Rickrolled by my own Spotify.
For some reason, you're striking me now as like a man in bed with his wife, and just the impotence has gotten a hold of him, and he's just like, "I'm really trying, honey. This is just the best I can do."
Vigorous thrusting, Dave.